All right, so as if last week was not heady enough, we're just going to continue rolling. And we're going to get into evidences from life sciences. And so our text at the top of page 79, it talks about of the major fields of scientific study. This chapter will deal with the evidences from life sciences, the studies of living organisms. So as you're going to see, and if you've gone through the text, you've seen we're going to start with the basic building blocks of cells. We're going to talk about DNA and RNA and messenger RNA and transitional RNA and all of those fun things. And we're going to kind of build our way up the physical science ladder. And we're going to look at animals. We're going to look at different things that are living organisms that I think as we study and as we look at, we can confidently say point us towards a creator. So one of the interesting things that I had personally never heard, and there's quite a few of these different theories, quite a few of these different topics that I've heard, and one of them we're going to discuss later. I remember being in a classroom in the 90s, and you know my teachers were excited about this, and there was a Nobel Prize winner that actually came about from the studies that I remember, you know, my teachers were really excited about and thinking that this was breaking science. So this one is something I was unfamiliar with, though. This is a popular theory about the origin of life. So, you know, we have scientists, as we talked in some of our previous lessons, who believe that, you know, from some sort of primordial ooze, from some sort of, you know, basic building block of life that eventually those basic building blocks changed and transformed and mutated and evolved, and now we have human beings because of it, right? So one of the logical arguments that we make is, well, okay, who made those basic building blocks, right? It's not like these things just came into existence, right? So who made these basic building blocks? And we've covered that before in a previous topic, but this is an interesting topic. The idea was, well, the basic building blocks were aboard a meteorite or a comet or space dust, and you know these basic amino acids came crashing in from space, and they found a hospitable environment in our ecosystem, and life came from outer space. And they think, ha, problem solved, right? No problem. You know, we just think that those organisms, they just came from another planet. But as I sit there and I read that, I think, okay, well, again, who created those organisms that were on the comets, that were on the meteors, that were on the space dust, right? That, again, there has to be some first-level situation that occurred that allows these amino acids to live on a comet, right? Or to live on a meteorite. And so, you know, the story that our text starts out with is in 1969, a meteorite impacted Earth in Western Australia, bringing with it what scientists determined to be amino acids, one of the simple organic molecules. So, you know, my thoughts on that, obviously, to kind of continue to poke holes at, well, you know, if we're going to say this is the origin of life, well, that origin of life had to have still started somewhere else and came down to Earth, right? So what does that look like? Where did that come from? So, you know, who or what formed them in space? How did they get there? And then, of course, how did we get from simple amino acids to full-blown humans, right? And I kind of, you know, was doing a little bit of digging about this, and a long time ago and a lifetime far away, you know, I did some bodybuilding. You know, I was in the military, and I was trying to get myself fit. And so I remember one of the supplements that I would take were amino acids. And I was sitting there thinking, you know, maybe in my barracks that I was inhabiting in 1999, maybe my amino acids, I should go back and check and see if they became humans. Yeah, I mean, it's possible, right? That was 20 years ago, so maybe. And I joke, but, you know, this is the idea, is that over this long period of time, that these simple building blocks became these complex systems. And we're going to talk some about some of the complex systems and how it's not by chance. You know, I'm convinced of that. It's not by chance that these complex systems happen to evolve in the way that they did in the living beings that we see. So another one that we have is man-made amino acids, right? So out of all of the elements that we know, scientists believe that human beings are made of about 25 elements, right? And if you read comic books, maybe you can throw another one or two in there for x-ray vision or flight or something, but you know, in the real world, scientists believe about 25 elements are associated and essential to life. And this isn't just humans. This is, you know, anything that's created, roughly 25 of these known elements. Just four of these, carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, and nitrogen, make up about 96% of the human body. So this got scientists to thinking, well, if I take these basic building blocks and we create what we believe the world would have looked like in the beginning, will something spontaneous happen? Right? And I know we've talked about some of these things in sermons recently. We've talked about some of these things in previous classes. You know, there was an experiment where they took a jar and they put meat in the jar, and if they left it exposed to air, flies would come in, lay eggs on the meat, and then boom, life. But if you sealed it off so that there was nothing to bring life in, life just doesn't spontaneously become created from meat, right? And so we look at these things and we say scientists can take basic building blocks and then using their intelligence, using their know-how, using their scientific capabilities, they can start to form some basic building blocks. But it doesn't just happen by chance. There has to be somebody intelligent that takes these things and are starting to assemble them, right? And there's plenty of examples of this, you know, Lego kits, right? I've never bought a fully assembled Lego kit. Some of these might have been sitting on the shelf for, you know, quite some time. And all the pieces are there, right? But not through any sort of happenstance did this Lego kit assemble itself. You know, there's some question as to whether or not the quote was actually attributed to Albert Einstein or not. But the story goes that someone was talking to Albert Einstein about his belief in God. And Albert Einstein's listening, and, you know, this guy's talking, and Albert Einstein takes his watch off, and he starts to disassemble his watch. And he puts it in a box, all of the disassembled pieces. And Albert Einstein just asks, if I pick up this box and shake it, is the watch going to put itself together? And, you know, the guy that had been arguing with Einstein says, no, that's crazy. And Albert Einstein says, you call that crazy? Right? This is what you're wanting us to believe, right? Is that something complex as the human body, as complex as our eyes or our nose or our ears, not just the entire human body, but pick an organ and look at what it does. And our belief is that somehow all of these things just happen to come together or happened to evolve. I got on my screen here, the connection has been lost, so hopefully, yeah, we'll continue. Perfect. So the next thing we've got is, you know, survival of the fittest. I see a connection here, but I don't know if it, there we go. It's kind of half there. Perfect. Whoa. All right. Let's slow down here a minute. There, one too many. Perfect. All right. So the next thing we have is survival of the fittest. And one of the things we get into with this kind of survival of the fittest is a concept that, you know, you may, if you put your way back hat on, remember. It's the idea of microevolution versus macroevolution, right? And microevolution is the idea that through selective breeding, through taking certain things, you can create a specific desired genetic trait, right? And we've seen that, and we've proven that, right? Macroevolution is the idea that we can take things and we can breed them and we can pick selective traits and we can, in essence, turn an orange into an apple, right? Well, you know, maybe if we take oranges that have a really hard rind and we just selectively breed those oranges, then eventually it'll become an apple rind, right? Or maybe if we take an orange that has, you know, seeds that are more like an apple seed, or, you know, maybe we'll try to splice apple seeds in with the oranges, and we'll try to make an apple out of an orange, right? And that's the idea of macroevolution. And why this is important and why we need to understand that macroevolution hasn't been proven is because evolutionists would have us believe that we came from some primordial ooze to some sort of thing with a flagellum to some sort of fish with gills to some sort of fish with legs to a monkey to a human. And that would be macroevolution. That would be the idea that we change our kind, right? And the Bible teaches us that you can't change your kind. And we've spoken about that again in previous lessons. But that's the idea, is that you're not going to get olives from a fig tree. You're not going to get grapes from an apple tree, right? They're only going to be able to produce their kind. Dogs can produce dogs. Cats can produce cats. But it's scientifically impossible for us to breed a dog and a cat together to make something new. So when we think about that, survival of the fittest, you know, people like to say, well, okay, you know, what about, you know, some sort of bacteria? You get a bacteria and you get sick and they give you antibiotics. And then that bacteria survives. You know, you're like me and you only take, you know, half of your antibiotics and you start feeling better. And yeah, it's my fault. And I'm done, right? I feel great. I don't have to take all of these. These antibiotics upset my stomach. They give me side effects and I'm feeling better. So I don't want to take my antibiotics anymore. And I've only killed 99.95% of the bacteria in me. And now that bacteria that's left over is strong enough to withstand the antibiotics. And then I get sick again and they say, well, we can't give you these antibiotics because what you have is resistant to those antibiotics. Good job. Right? Next time, do what we tell you. So people will say, aha, evolution, right? And I would like to bring up the idea and the theory of micro and macro evolution. That bacteria is still bacteria. The bacteria did not turn into a bunny, right? The bacteria, even though it got stronger, even though it changed some of its micro, properties, it's still bacteria. It didn't change its kind. And so when we think about natural selection, sure, we can say that, right? I mean, we were taught these things in high school, and some of them might make a little bit of sense, right? So giraffes, you know, there might have one time been short-necked giraffes, even though we don't see any fossils or anything saying short-necked giraffe. And then there were long-necked giraffes, and everything was down here eating the foliage that was low. So the giraffes that were short-necked starved and died. And so the long-necked giraffes survived because they could eat the tops of the trees. You know, and these are theories. But the thing is, a giraffe is still a giraffe, right? A giraffe didn't come from something else. Yes?
So to kind of add to the survival of the fittest, I always found it interesting because think about a bacteria. Bacteria can live for a really long time.
Sure. Yep.
Not our standard human years, like way longer.
Yep.
So why would we ever decide to mutate and become a bunny?
Yeah.
Because I can live thousands of years as a bacteria.
Right. And yeah. You know? If survival is what's important to me, I'm at the top of the food chain, right? Exactly. Yep. Absolutely. And so, you know, that's one of the things, you know, yes, it gives us an example of evolution because there have been changes, but it hasn't changed its kind, right? And so that's the idea that I want to talk about, with micro and macro evolution. And so, you know, we talk about this, the idea of small scale change, bacteria becoming resistant to antibodies, it's still a bacteria, versus a large scale or a macro change, bacteria becoming a different kind. And, you know, our texts talk about this. This was covered in depth previously in lesson 5 and lesson 7. I know, you know, we've got plenty of copies of those lessons. There's plenty to be had out there. The next thing to talk about is, you know, ribosome design. And this was the part for me that I spent probably a good 2 days because this is not my scientific wheelhouse, right? And so the idea behind it is that every living thing we're taught has DNA, right? And so every living thing has to recreate that DNA and recreate the protein that's required for things like hair loss or cellular regeneration, things like that. So what I learned was, you know, again, this is interesting to me. This shows intelligent design, is that DNA is too big to fit through the nucleic walls of a cell, right? So what I've learned from that is that the DNA, the two strands that we see, that's kind of the background of this picture here, it's too big. So what happens instead is that our body, some intelligent designer, some happenstance, right, depending on where you are in the argument, our body can copy our DNA in something that's called RNA. And so RNA is basically half a strand. And so the way RNA works is that it has the matching code for what it's copying. So if you have, you know, a triangle and the matching code is a triangle, it'll copy that triangle. And then the next sequence in the code is a square, it'll copy the square, and then a triangle, and then a circle, and it'll copy that code, and it'll basically take half of itself, go out of the cell, go into ribosome, and then it'll start using that sequence to build DNA. And that's how our bodies continue to have cellular regeneration. That's how, as we get older, that's how when we burn our mouths, that our mouth heals. When we cut our finger, that our fingers heal. You know, our cells will regenerate. And so we see this idea. And this isn't specific to humans. This is any living organism. And so you sit there and you see that. And again, you think, is this by chance? Right? Or did somebody really smart decide to put this together? You know, again, it's like I went to Jason's Deli today, and I got myself one of their sandwiches. And it had chicken, and it had guacamole, and it had cheese, and it was a really good sandwich. And I sit there and I think, well, did this sandwich assemble itself on accident? Right? Or did somebody intelligent say bread, chicken, cheese, guacamole, you know, and somebody put that together? And in the same way, when you look at all of these fine, minute details of our body, it's really hard to sit there and say, well, this happened by accident, right? Let's go all the way back to the beginning. This is my beginning spot over here. Let's go all the way back to the beginning and say space dust, right? And so space dust brought some amino acids down, and somehow these amino acids learned how to replicate, and then somehow these amino acids taught us how to grow legs and hair and ears and eyes, and we went from some simple single-celled organism to being able to walk, talk, and converse about these things, right? And it doesn't make sense. To me, I think the first couple chapters of the Bible explains to us much more succinctly and much more clearly that man was created as man. The man was not created as space dust. It just happened to, over a long period of time, become man. You know, the text goes into a little bit more information, and again, there's plenty of YouTube videos out there. I found probably about 14 videos, again, on Khan Academy. I sit and watched all of them, and then I rewatched them, and I think I watched them a third time, just to try to be able to intelligently speak about this. And some of the stuff is still pretty heady. The good news is, I think this is probably the most complicated or complex part of what we'll talk about tonight. But I wanted to delve into this with some understanding, so that we could see, you know, these sorts of things don't happen by accident, right? So this is what I was talking about with the DNA coding, right? So on the RNA, on the DNA, we have these different codes. And for the life of me, I don't remember what they are. It's like a U, a G, an A, a T. There's all these different letters, right? And so recently, you know, I did 23andMe. And it was kind of cool because they had all these videos that kind of showed me how DNA worked and how they replicate the DNA. And so it was a very high level, you know, commercialized overview so that I could see these things. And then as I was going in a little bit deeper, it was interesting. But you know, these are the basic building blocks that are encoded on that RNA that the RNA takes with it to the ribosomes and then starts to replicate DNA and starts to grow new cells. And so the quote that we have here from our text that I thought was pretty on the nose, it said, "It's not possible for a code of any kind to arise by chance or accident. A code is the work of an intelligent mind. Even the cleverest dog or chimpanzee could not work out a code of any kind. It's obvious, then, that chance can't do it. This could no more have been the work of chance or accidents than could the Moonlight Sonata be played by mice running up and down the keyboard of my piano. Codes do not arise from chaos. I thought that was pretty interesting because, again, in my field, what I do for a living, I work in IT. And I've been a network guy, route switch, firewalls, hooking everything up together for 20 years. World's changing, right? And anyone that's in IT or anyone that's in technology knows the way I've done business for the last 15 years is going away. Everything is going to rapid, on-demand, I want it now, right? So you move into your house, you want the internet turned on. They don't want to wait for some guy to come out with a big tool belt and a special crimpers and then clip everything together. They just want to be able to say, hey, flip a switch, give me my internet, right? Well, it's no different. In my particular field, we work with hospitals and doctors and all kinds of different electronic health records. Well, when somebody purchases something from us, 9 times out of 10, they figured out we're not AHA compliant, Affordable Care Act, excuse me, ACA compliant. We're not Affordable Care Act compliant. We need to get compliant real quick. So they go and they look at someone like us and they say, you offer us everything we need. I need this by Friday. And we go, it's Thursday, right? And so we have to be able to hook all of those things up in a very short amount of time. So what I've had to do is basically relearn who I am and do this all through computer code. And that capability exists now, where I can do all of my routing, all of my switching, all of my firewalls, all of my neat network stuff that I do, that I could sit there and actually talk your ear off for a long time about. I can do that with a code. And basically I can go in, add a couple variables, hit run, and it builds the entire network for them, right? And so when we talk about these sorts of things, DNA, right? And our book talks about the idea that we're still continuing to figure out what DNA is, right? The reason that the company's called 23andMe for DNA is they're like, well, we've identified 23 strands or 23 characteristics of your DNA that help us to tell who you are. If you're going to have red hair, blonde hair, you know, who your family genealogy is. And you sit there and you look at DNA and you realize there's hundreds and thousands of characteristics. And we figured out 23 of them, right? And so scientists right now, and it was more prevalent in the late 90s, they had a thing called junk DNA. And that's one of the questions our book asks. Well, what's junk DNA? And that's code for we don't know what it does, right? So extra stuff in the DNA strand that we have no idea. It just looks like random bits and coding. But as we continue to unravel and understand DNA, we continue to understand, like, no, that's important, right? These things are neat. These things are interesting. And so this is what the writer's talking about, is there's no way that could have just randomly happened. There's no way that, again, from space dust to who we are today, that the DNA randomly coded itself in such a way. Just like there's no way that I could call up, you know, Wide Open West tomorrow and say, hey, I want internet, and just randomly it connects, right? Somebody has to go somewhere and run the command line strings, do what they need to do to hook the internet up, right? Any thoughts on that? I realized, other than Jeff one time, I haven't really paused for questions, so I apologize. This is heady material, a lot to get through, so I apologize. If you guys have anything, please feel free to just put your hand up. Yes?
It reminds me of when I was teaching something similar to this in junior high class last year. I showed them a blank computer screen, and there was nothing on it. It was just blank. So then I copy and pasted 50 lines of code that I created prior to, and then ran it. And it was just a little guy that just ran around the screen. Very simple.
Right. And if you would have put the kids there, and right, they would have been hitting keys, right? But but there was no intelligent input there. And I'm not saying our kids aren't intelligent, but there's a form and a factor. There's a design to it that you have to know.
And that's exactly
right.
Code.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, and that's the point. Hopefully, I made without belaboring it too much. Of, you know, the idea of working in IT, right? Code just doesn't accidentally happen. When you're able to open up your smartphone and go to your email, somebody wrote that code, right? It wasn't like one day the Apple engineers were just like, hey, look what just accidentally happened. We can get the email, right? Somebody wrote that code. And so it's the same way. Hey, look what accidentally happened. I have opposable thumbs, right? It's the same sort of crazy idea. Like these sorts of things don't just happen. And we talk about this in conclusion regarding DNA. Nothing works unless everything works at the same time. It could not have gradually come into existence. Special creation is required for DNA to exist. And the idea that the book has with this is something like a bird's wings, right? There's no way that it just like evolved a feather and then evolved like a little bit of a bone structure. Because what purpose would a feather have had for a bird in survival of the fittest? What purpose would a feather have had for evolution? A single feather is not going to do anything, right? So it's again, almost immediately, like the entire wing and the complex structure that goes into a wing happened, right? It wasn't like a fish one day woke up and had a wing. Right? So, and it wasn't a small gradual change because that doesn't make sense. It would have had to have been all at one time. You know, Jeff mentioned that the junior high class, we were talking about this beetle, and I think it's called a bombardier beetle, if I remember correctly. This was a couple weeks ago in the junior high class. And so the bombardier beetle has two different cavities inside of its stomach. And the first one holds like this acid mixture. And the second one holds another mixture, and when the bombardier beetle is in trouble, the first one empties into the second one, and it makes a mixture, and the bombardier beetle is able to spray it to hit its whatever's trying to hunt it, and it's like 600 degrees. It's like this chemically heated thing that just heats up to 600 degrees. And I was reasoning with my high school kid, or my junior high kids, I'm like, how would that have just gradually happened? Like one day you wake up and you have a chamber in your stomach? I don't know. And then, you know, a couple generations later, you get a second chamber that just happens to also work. And then prey comes and it mixes together and you don't have the little, expelling jets yet, so you just explode. Like, you have to realize, like, the whole system has to be in place, right? And so these are the things that we look at is if one piece of this doesn't work, we don't have a bombardier beetle, right? And so we look at these things and we understand that the entire structure had to be in place. So, and again, even if you did it in reverse, all right, let's say the bombardier beetle got its little jet sprays first. You know, enemy comes up and it's like, ha, and it points an empty jet spray. It's eaten, right? It's dead. That's not survival of the fittest because it's got no way to defend itself. So somehow, this entire system came into being. And evolution doesn't seem to be the answer for that. Alan? Absolutely not. No. So one of the things we're going to talk about here in a minute is the idea, there's a scientist in the 80s and in the 90s that were modifying fruit flies. And he was able to find the specific genetic coding, and started manipulating it, thinking, I'm gonna prove evolution. And really all that he did was prove that he was either killing fruit flies at the next generation or he was creating some horrible mutation and the fruit fly didn't work the way it was supposed to. Right? It wasn't designed the way it was supposed to. And the reason for that, if I remember right, I don't remember the exact life cycle. Fruit flies have like a 15-day life cycle. So they were able to rapidly see multiple generations by changing the genetic coding. And so the scientists in the 80s did that. And I remember my teachers being all excited. And I think it was 95 he got a Nobel Prize for that. Cool stuff. But at the end of the day, it was fruitless. You know, no pun intended. But a couple people chuckled. At the end of the day, it didn't prove anything. It just proved that if you try to modify the DNA, all you're going to do is kill the thing, right? And so, again, we have to look at the idea some sort of intelligent creator. Complexity of life, and a lot of this stuff's kind of intermingles in my head, so I just have a couple prompts here to help out. This is the same sort of idea. The mathematical chances that a protein would form by chance is 10 to the 164th power. That's 10 and 164 zeros, right? If there was a lottery for that tomorrow, there would be people lined up for miles trying to get a lottery ticket, right? Because that's a lot of money, right? We do it for 7, 8, 9 zeros. You know, there are people that are like, well, $1 billion is a lot. You sit there and think about 10 to the 164th power, the mathematical chances that a protein would form by chance, right? It's nigh impossible. Kevin, did you have something?
Well, isn't math is one of the sciences, right?
Yeah, and we'll talk about that next week. But if you have a question, I'm a couple weeks ahead because this is heavy stuff, so.
No, it seems like the math department should be arguing with the science evolution department.
You think? Who said that?
They do a lot.
Do they?
Yeah. Well, at least we're in West Virginia.
I don't know if we want to use West Virginia math as the basis for our defense. I only kid. I went to high school in West Virginia, to Alan's point earlier. But Alan. Yeah, so it is what's called hard science next week. So it's math, it's computers, it's all of these different things that we're going to be talking about that's hard science. But math is part of that, mathematics. So, and it's funny, it's interesting how, you know, some things in math speak to a divine creator. Not so much computers, although I'm using computers as an example. You know, a computer doesn't necessarily speak to there being a God, but a computer speaks to there being a Steve Jobs. Right? A computer speaks to there being a Bill Gates. There was somebody there that created these things and put them together and had the idea of how to make them work. Right? They didn't just spontaneously occur. We've got all the copper, right? We as man have even made capacitors and resistors and CPUs, and you know, why one day do we not walk into Micro Center and there's 1,000 newly assembled computers? All the parts are there, right? Somebody has to go and do that. And if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to do it again because you're going to mess the computer up, right? And so those are some of the things we're going to talk about, is just the idea that the more complex something becomes, the more we understand that there has to be some intelligence behind it. There's no way that happenstance can occur. You know, irreducible complexity. I was familiar with this. Did you have something?
I did. That's complaining.
Yep. And it's interesting because on the flip side, you know, and I'm sure that a lot of us that have been Christians for a long time in this room, I remember it taught to me that if you take, I think it was an 8-foot by 8-foot room, and you fill it full of quarters, and you mark one of them, that you had as much chance of going in and picking out that one quarter as Jesus Christ had of fulfilling all the prophecies that he fulfilled, right? It was some crazy high mathematical formula like that. But the thing is, the scriptures teach us Jesus Christ did exactly that, right? He fulfilled all of those prophecies. Everything that was recorded in the Old Testament, Jesus Christ fulfilled. And it was the same sort of crazy odds. Like I said, I believe, if I remember correct, 8 by 8 room filled with quarters, mark one, and you pick that one, right? And so you think about that, and you just realize, like, mathematically impossible, yes. But on the other side, we use that to prove Christ's divinity, right? That there's really no way that it could have happened. So, yeah, and yeah, I don't know the math behind it, but there's, I'm sure somebody somewhere did that. So irreducible complexity, we spoke a little bit about this. This is the idea that if you take one thing, one part, one piece away from a completed product, it doesn't function, right? And the real basic idea is a mousetrap. You've got the metal, you've got the wood, you've got the metal, you've got the spring, you've got the latch, you've got the cheese. You know, you've got all these things that make a simple mousetrap. What happens if you take away the spring? Right. It's complex enough. It's simple enough that you can identify all the parts, but it's complex enough that if you take away one part, it doesn't work. Right? And so if I set out to design a mousetrap and I take just one part away, it doesn't work. And so this is the idea, right? It's a teleological argument for God. Again, why would a singular part appear without the entire system, right? Why would a singular piece of something come into existence if the whole system was not already planned and designed? And again, we can pick an organ. We can pick a part of our body, we could pick a blade of grass, we could pick a leaf, right? Something that is living. And we sit there and we realize that there's an entire system in each and every thing that we look at. And if we take one part of that away, the system fails, right? And this is the idea, irreducible complexity. And there was, again, a very heady video that I found out there that I thought was pretty amazing. And it talked about if you zoom in to the tiniest building block of life that we're able to see, that there's a little flagellum. But the flagellum doesn't operate by itself. It has basically a natural motor that fires an electrical current around this flagellum that allows cells to maneuver everywhere, right? And so they're sitting there and they're talking about that. And it's like you take the flagellum away, you don't have the propulsion. You take one of those cells away from that electrical circuit that allows the flagellum to spin, you lose locomotion, right? And it was crazy because they were talking about just this small individual cell in the flagellum that they were like, oh man, we are not getting through everything. you lost the entire design of what it was supposed to be. And in the same way, if we look at our eyeballs, if we take away our cornea, our retinas, the things that allow us to see color, the things that allow us to adjust to light, you lose the entire function of the eyeball. And so to that point, the human eye, just the retina, says it's 10 times thinner than a sheet of saran wrap. Right. I like food. I'm very familiar with saran wrap. I'm sure most everybody is. 10 times thinner. So you look at that and you realize sensitivity to light range of 10 billion to 1. And it said that the best film that we have to capture light and capture an image has a sensitivity of light of 1,000 to 1. Did that happen by chance? Right? 10 billion to 1 to 1,000 to 1. It says the eye can sense a single photon in a dark room. And it's interesting because, you know, again, being a Navy guy, having been deployed overseas on a warship, at night, they wouldn't let people smoke. And the reason why is you would go out onto the open air of the ship and you would light a cigarette. And they said that was like setting off a 4th of July firework to anybody that was looking for you. Anybody in land could sit there and go, cigarette. That little ember from miles away because there's no trees, right? As long as the natural curve of the earth, you're not sitting beyond the horizon, somebody's naked eye could see that cigarette being lit. That's how sensitive our eyes are, right? And it says there's 10 million light-sensitive cells in the retina, and that's 200 million cells per millimeter of the retina, right? So again, it happenstance that we have these particular light-sensitive cells in our eyes. Did you have something, Tim?
No.
Okay. Hummingbirds. So I thought this was neat. One of the things I didn't know about hummingbirds, its weight is 1/14 of 1 ounce. And 3/4 of the weight is its wing muscles. Its bones are hollow. It only takes in oxygen one way. We inhale and exhale. It takes in oxygen one way. And they actually push the oxygen through the hollow of its bones to cool the bird down. And it literally has to hibernate at night because it moves so fast that if it didn't hibernate, it would starve to death. So during its waking hours, it's constantly eating because it burns so many calories. Something that's 1/14 of 1 ounce. And that happened by happenstance, right? If you take away one of those systems from the hummingbird, we're talking about an extinct species. We're talking about something that is not with us anymore. So a hummingbird, all of its complexity was designed in such a way. Fish, three different types of fish we talked about. The angler fish, I thought this was neat. Everybody knows the movie, the fish that has the little bulb. Whoa, that got loud. The fish that has the little bulb, that's an angler fish. I learned that only females have that bulb because they eat. And then the male actually attaches to the female and eats through her bloodstream. It happened by happenstance, right? That only the females evolved in such a way to get the bulb. And then the males. So, and we got a couple other fish. We talked about frogs with legs. And then this was the fruit flies, right? So I kind of wanted to push forward to that because I think we're pretty much done. I see kids. So, a lot of stuff. Again, you know, I mean, this is what, 15, 16 pages of stuff. So I always try every week to get through it all, but, and then there are discussion questions, which were toward the end. But hopefully you guys learned something. I know I do. Thank you very much for allowing me to teach this.